Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling, well, perhaps the biggest question there is, what happens when we die? You know, do we just stop? Or does something carry on? This deep dive is all about consciousness beyond death. We're looking at what science, what theoretical physics, and what ancient spirituality had to say about it all. Our mission, to dig through, you know, scientific papers, philosophy, spiritual texts, all of it. Find the key takeaways for you. Think of it like a shortcut to getting informed, hopefully with some surprises, some aha moments along the way. It's a huge topic, but we'll try to give you different angles without making your head spin. Okay, let's jump straight in with something many people find, well, really compelling evidence. Near-death experiences, NDEs, and also out-of-body experiences, OBEs. Now, these aren't new ideas. People have talked about them for centuries. But modern medicine, modern psychology, they're looking at them with fresh eyes, with real scrutiny.
Yeah, and right away you hit this this really deep neurobiological paradox. See, NDEs often happen during clinical death, like, say, cardiac arrest. And usually the brain's cortex, its electrical activity, it basically flatlines within, what, 10 to 20 seconds. But then you have maybe 10, 20% of survivors who come back describing these long, really clear, super detailed experiences. They often say it felt realer than real, much more vivid than just everyday life, which is, you know, the complete opposite of the amnesia you'd normally expect after something like that.
It's totally baffling, isn't it? And this out-of-body thing, you said about 45% report feeling separate from their body.
Yeah.
Looking down on things.
Yeah.
How do we know these aren't just, I don't know, vivid hallucinations? Okay, let's unpack this a bit.
Well, that's where veridical perception comes in. It's a key piece. It means people accurately see or hear things during their NDE that, physically speaking, they absolutely could not have perceived from where their body was. Like, there's this documented case, a 44-year-old guy in coronary care. He's comatose, clinically out. Afterwards, he describes exactly where a nurse put his dentures, on a specific shelf of the crash cart, things he just couldn't have seen.
Wow. From a coma.
Exactly. And it's not just one story. There are studies, Dr. Penny Sartori, Dr. Janice Holden, they found NDEers were surprisingly accurate describing their own resuscitations, much better than control groups just guessing. One review looked at, like, 89 published OBE cases, found 92% were, quote, completely accurate.
And even, you know, anecdotal stuff can be powerful. Like Marta, this 5-year-old girl, legally blind from birth. During her NDE, she described seeing a beautiful lady dressed in bright white light. How do you explain that visually? So these accounts, they're particularly difficult to explain by any known physical brain function. Seeing things accurately while you're clinically comatose. That's the core puzzle.
Yeah, that really does throw a wrench in the works for a simple brain-only explanation. So even with these powerful stories, scientists are still trying to figure it out physically, right? Yeah. What are the main ideas trying to keep it all, you know, inside the skull? How do they tackle those observations? Well, one of the big neuroscientific ideas focuses on a surge of neurophysiologic gamma oscillations, basically a burst of high-frequency brain waves. Gamma waves, they're usually linked to complex thought, consciousness, memory recall, that kind of thing. This burst happens right around cardiac arrest in a part of the brain some call the consciousness hot zone.
Oh, okay.
So the thinking is maybe this is the brain's sort of last hurrah, a reaction to the sudden lack of oxygen and glucose. Maybe that neural activity creates the vivid NDE experience.
Interesting idea. But you said there are challenges.
There are. For one, these studies often have really small sample sizes. It's hard to generalize. Plus, there's debate about where those gamma waves are really coming from. Is it definitely the brain, or could it be, say, muscle activity nearby that the EEG picks up?
I see. Interference.
Possibly.
Wrong.
And maybe the biggest hurdle, how do you get from measuring electrical waves, an objective thing, to the subjective feeling of being out of your body or seeing a life review? That jump is still, well, it's a huge gap.
Right. So what about psychological explanations?
Okay, so from a psychological angle, some view NDEs and OBEs as maybe a type of dissociation, like a coping mechanism. The idea is that facing extreme trauma, like dying, triggers this detachment as a way to protect the mind. There was one study, over 500 people, it found links between OBEs, certain mental health conditions, and interestingly, childhood trauma, suggesting maybe it's a kind of a learned dissociative response to overwhelming stress.
Okay, that reframing could help reduce stigma, which is definitely good.
Yeah.
But does that explain the vertical perception part, seeing the dentures on the cart?
That's the sticking point. These psychological models, while useful, don't really have a solid way to account for that verifiable objective information NDEers sometimes bring back. So we circle back to that paradox.
Yeah. Feels like we're going in circles sometimes.
It can feel that way. But, you know, regardless of why it happens, brain surge, dissociation, something else entirely, the impact on the people who have these experiences is undeniable. So many report profound life changes, less fear of death, more peace, a different outlook on life. That personal transformation is very real.
That transformation really makes you think about the bigger picture of consciousness itself. So we've looked at the experiences, the science trying to explain them. Let's shift gears a bit. Let's move into the more theoretical realms. Physics, philosophy. What do they say? Is consciousness just brain stuff or something more?
Yeah, this is where you get into a really fundamental philosophical split. The dominant view in science, you could call it the identity theory of mind, basically says consciousness is brain activity. It emerges from all that neural complexity. So brain dies, lights out, consciousness ceases, like a TV show ending when you switch off the TV. And the evidence they point to is, you know, brain damage affecting consciousness, drugs altering it, that kind of thing.
The standard model, basically.
Pretty much. The opposing view, which you find in some philosophies like idealism or forms of dualism, suggests consciousness is more fundamental, separate even. In this view, the brain isn't the generator. It's more like a receiver, or maybe a filter, like a radio tuning into a broadcast. Destroy the radio, the music itself doesn't vanish, just the ability to hear it through that device.
Okay, the radio analogy. But that's harder to prove, right?
That's the big challenge, yeah. It's often seen as unfalsifiable, lacking a clear empirical way to test it.
So into this debate comes integrated information theory. IITs. Heard a bit about this. It's meant to be more mathematical.
Exactly. Developed by Giulio Tononi, a neuroscientist, IIT tries to ground consciousness in mathematics. The core idea is that consciousness isn't exclusive to brains. It's potentially a property of any system that has a certain kind of complex integrated information processing. It measures this complexity with a value called phi. Now, here's the kicker for our topic. IIT suggests consciousness, or phi, never actually drops to absolute zero, even at death.
Never zero, so it continues.
In a way, when the brain, this incredibly complex system with high phi, disintegrates, its overall phi value plummets. But the theory suggests consciousness doesn't just vanish, it would sort of shift. It would redistribute to whatever local combination of matter has the next highest, albeit much, much lower phi value. Which could be, well, things like the bacteria breaking down the body.
Wait, so consciousness continues in the bacteria?
Yeah.
That's not quite the afterlife most people...
Precisely. It's not annihilative, yes. Consciousness doesn't technically end. But, and this is the huge philosophical cost, there's nothing in IIT that preserves your personal identity, your memories, your sense of self, your soul. None of that carries over.
So it's consciousness, but not you.
Right. It's dispersed, fragmented, impersonal, not the kind of continuity most people are looking for.
Okay. What else is out there in the theoretical world? Quantum immortality. That sounds dramatic.
It is pretty out there. It stems from the many worlds interpretation, or MWI, of quantum mechanics.
Remind me, MWI is the idea that every quantum event splits the universe.
Basically, yeah. Every possible outcome of a quantum measurement happens, each in its own parallel universe, a constantly branching reality. So physicist Max Tegmark took this idea and applied it to mortality. The theory goes, if you face a situation that could kill you, say a game of quantum Russian roulette from your subjective viewpoint, you will always find yourself in one of the universes where you survive.
Because consciousness can only continue in a branch where you don't die.
That's the logic. Your consciousness essentially follows the surviving path. So subjectively, you'd seem immortal, constantly dodging fatal events by shifting to a timeline where you didn't die.
Okay, that sounds kind of cool. Eternal life through quantum loopholes. But there's got to be a catch, right? What's the downside for me, for my sense of self?
A big one. The you that survives is just one version. Think of all the other branches where slightly different versions of you did make slightly different choices, formed different relationships, maybe even died. Your unique personal history, your relationships in this timeline, they get diluted or lost across infinite branches. You might survive, but are you still truly you in the same meaningful way?
Losing your story.
Exactly. And it doesn't solve the problem of, say, aging or gradual decline. Eventually, your body would likely deteriorate to a point where no branch involves survival.
So these theories, IIT, quantum immortality, they offer ways consciousness might not just stop, but they don't really give us the personal survival most people hope for.
Generally, no. They often come at the cost of individual identity as we understand it.
Okay, let's leave the physics labs and philosophical debates for a moment. For thousands of years, people have turned to spirituality and religion for answers about death. What do these ancient traditions tell us?
Well, you see some broad patterns. In many Eastern traditions, like Hinduism, there's this idea of cyclical existence. The Atman, the self or soul, is seen as eternal. It goes through samsara, the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth, inhabiting different bodies. And your journey through samsara is governed by karma. Every action, even thought, creates ripples that determine your future rebirths until you finally achieve moksha, liberation from the cycle.
Karma is a cosmic cause and effect.
Absolutely. Buddhism also has a cycle of rebirths driven by karma, aiming for liberation, which they call nirvana. But interestingly, traditional Buddhism doesn't posit a permanent, unchanging soul like the Hindu Atman. It's more like a stream of consciousness or karmic tendencies that continues and shapes the next life.
And it's striking, isn't it, how some elements of modern NDEs, the life review, feeling detached from the body echo descriptions you find in some of these ancient texts, like the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
It is quite remarkable, yes. Then you have the Abrahamic faiths, Christianity, Islam, which generally view the journey as more linear. In Christianity, typically the soul or spirit goes to be with God immediately after death, awaiting a future bodily resurrection and final judgment. So death is seen as a transition, a single finite event leading ultimately to heaven or hell based on faith and deeds.
So there's some debate within Christianity too, right? About soul sleep.
There is, yes. Whether the soul is conscious immediately or waits unconsciously. But the core idea is a linear path to a final destiny. Islam has a similar structure. The soul, the ruh, enters an intermediate state called barzakh after death. It's a waiting period until the day of judgment when everyone is resurrected, judged by Allah based on their life's actions, and then sent to either paradise, jannah, or hell, jahannam.
So a definite judgment based on life. What about other traditions, indigenous beliefs, ancient ones?
You find incredible diversity there. Many indigenous cultures practice forms of animism where there isn't such a sharp divide between the physical and spiritual worlds. Spirits are in everything, and the living and the dead often coexist, interacting. A really fascinating example is the Torajan people in Indonesia. They believe the dead remain part of the community. They might keep the body in the home for weeks, months, even years, treating it as if the person is just sleeping or sick before the big funeral rites.
Right.
And they have the mon ritual where they periodically exhume their ancestors, clean them, dress them in new clothes, and celebrate with them. It's a very different relationship with death.
Definitely. And ancient Egypt. Mummies, pyramids. They clearly thought a lot about it.
Hugely important. For them, death wasn't an end, but a crucial transition. The soul had to navigate the underworld, the duat, facing trials to reach the field of reeds, their version of paradise. This journey culminated in the famous weighing of the heart ceremony. Your heart was weighed against the feather of Ma'at, the goddess of truth. If your heart was light, free from sin, you got eternal life. If it was heavy, well, it was devoured and you ceased to exist.
The ultimate final exam.
You could say that.
Yeah.
And if you connect all these threads, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, ancient Egypt, many others, there's a powerful common theme running through almost all of them.
Which is?
That the afterlife, whatever form it takes, is somehow linked to your conduct in this life.
Mm.
Whether it's karma shaping rebirth, a final judgment, or your heart being weighed, there's this idea of moral consequence. It's a near universal driver for ethics.
That's a really important point. Okay, so from these grand spiritual frameworks, let's zoom back into the personal level.
Right.
Because ultimately, these questions touch us individually. And sometimes the most powerful insights come from personal stories.
Absolutely. And one of the most talked about modern accounts is Dr. Eben Alexander's. He was a neurosurgeon, very much a scientific materialist. Then in 2008, he gets severe bacterial meningitis. Ends up in a coma for a week. His cortex, the thinking part of the brain, was supposedly completely inactive, essentially shut down by the infection. Yet he claims he had this incredibly vivid, hyper-real experience, a journey to a heavenly realm, encounters with a divine being, feelings of immense love and interconnectedness. He wrote a bestseller about it, Proof of Heaven.
A really compelling story, especially coming from a neurosurgeon. But as we know, it wasn't without its critics, was it? There was quite a bit of pushback.
There certainly was. Other neuroscientists, like Sam Harris, were highly skeptical. They argued Alexander maybe didn't fully understand the state of his brain, or that the visions could have happened as his brain was coming back online during recovery, or maybe influenced by the drugs he was given. An article in Esquire magazine also raised questions, pointing out some discrepancies between his popular account and his actual medical records. Now, Dr. Alexander stands by his story. He argues the quality of his experience was fundamentally different from any dream or hallucination he's ever had. But it really underscores the difficulty, doesn't it? How do you verify such a subjective experience?
Exactly. Personal testimony is powerful, but it's not scientific data in the same way.
Precisely. It's compelling, it resonates with many, but accepting it as definitive proof is a huge leap for science.
And it's worth remembering, too, not all NDEs are like Alexander's. Some people report really distressing experiences, right? Feeling trapped in a void or encountering hostile beings.
That's true. There are accounts of terrifying voids, intense isolation, or even inverse NDEs where normally positive elements like the life review feel judgmental or hostile. It suggests that if there is something beyond, it might not be uniformly pleasant or blissful.
Adds another layer of complexity. What about past life regression? People claiming to remember previous lives.
That's another area rich with personal accounts, though highly controversial scientifically. The classic case is Bridie Murphy from the 1950s. A woman named Virginia Tighe, under hypnosis, seemed to recall details of a 17th century life in Ireland, names, places, slang that investigators later found some evidence for, things she seemingly couldn't have known normally.
Fascinating, but again, hard to prove definitively. Hypnosis, memory, it's tricky.
Extremely tricky. Skeptics point to cryptomnesia, forgotten memories surfacing, or the power of suggestion. But putting aside the proof question, many people find PLR therapeutically valuable. They report gaining insights, healing past traumas, understanding current life patterns, maybe finding more self-compassion by, say, exploring a past life where they felt lonely or unloved.
So even if you're skeptical about the literal truth of remembering past lives, it can still have a positive psychological impact for the person experiencing it.
Absolutely. And what stands out to me looking across NDEs, PLR, even some mystical experiences in ancient texts, it's the shared elements. Despite wildly different cultural contexts and explanations, you see recurring themes. The sense of being out of body, moving through a tunnel or towards a light, the life review, meeting deceased relatives or beings of light, a feeling of peace or oneness.
Common threads weaving through it all.
Exactly. It suggests these might be fundamental aspects of the human experience when consciousness approaches or crosses the threshold of death, whatever the ultimate explanation turns out to be.
So where does this leave us? We've journeyed through NDE reports, brain science, quantum physics, ancient religions, personal stories, and it seems pretty clear there's no single easy answer to what happens after death.
No, definitely not. What we have is this incredibly rich, complex landscape full of profound questions, fascinating possibilities, and yeah, a lot of contradictions too.
So maybe the point isn't finding the answer.
Yeah, maybe the real value of digging into all this isn't about getting a definitive verdict on the afterlife. Perhaps it's more about how exploring these questions affects how we live our lives right now.
That's a really interesting thought. And the psychological side is complex too, isn't it? Believing in an afterlife can reduce fear of death for many.
It can, yes. Research often shows that. But interestingly, some studies suggest it's actually certainty that brings the most comfort. People who are very religious and people who are committed atheists often report lower death anxiety than those who are uncertain or questioning.
So being firmly in one camp or the other helps. More than just vaguely believing.
It seems so. Being in between can sometimes correlate with higher anxiety. And there's a paradox, too. Belief can provide comfort, but it can also sometimes make grieving harder, fueling a intense yearning for reunion that delays acceptance.
Hadn't thought of that angle.
And beyond the personal comfort level, there's that powerful ethical dimension we touched on earlier. That idea of a moral ledger, that our actions here have consequences beyond this life. It's been such a consistent feature across cultures and history. Whether you believe it literally or not, you can see how that concept has shaped human societies, encouraged cooperation, and provided a framework for morality for millennia.
Yeah, the idea that life matters in some ultimate sense.
Exactly.
So maybe the search for what happens after we die. Maybe it's a question that's not meant to be definitively answered. Maybe its real purpose isn't to give us certainty about the end, but to make us think more deeply about the life we're living right now. It forces you to confront what you value, how you treat others, what kind of legacy you want to leave. Whether you land on believing in oblivion or fragmented consciousness or an eternal soul, just grappling with mortality can push you towards living with more intention, more meaning, maybe even more courage. In the end, perhaps the most important question isn't what happens when we die, but how does asking that question change how we live? Something to think about.